I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves podcast. You know, I think one of the most complex dances in life is being able to effectively manage conflict with our partners. You know, that's true of anyone we love or like anyone we're in relationship. That can be true of a stranger actually in a comment section of a social media post and Facebook or wherever the fuck we hang out now and argue about things. But my point being that romantic relationships, it's especially important that we learn this skill, that we learn this dance that couples do and how to change the dance so it's more productive, more intimate, more effective. And yeah, we just get to learn about one another more. You know, a lot of the time we believe or feel as though a successful relationship has an absence of conflict. And I don't think there could be something more untrue. Successful relationships just handle conflict differently. You know, they manage conflict differently. Conflict itself is really a bridge to deeper understanding, to deeper intimacy, to the healing of former patterns, patterns that we picked up as children. And really, a relationship that can learn how to do that dance and do it well can really bring us to whole new levels of ourselves. And if we can do it in romantic relationship, and I always joke that also in our relationship with our mothers, because moms seem to be triggering in a lot of ways, because it's our primary, you know, main attuned attachment. And yeah, it's just like, if we can learn those, oh my gosh, like regular everyday interactions or conflicts with people are just so much more simple because we've begun to master it in this other section. So I can't say enough about that. That's really the work all of us are need to do and are here to do. And it's just so healing and it just requires so much of us. And I'm so excited. The podcast interview today is with Nick Solacek. And Nick is a coach. He's a writer. He's a speaker. He does men's coaching too, but he works with couples. That's like really his deepest passion. And he's exceptional. He's exceptional. And, he has for a long time been a friend, and I just really admire him and his work and his way of speaking about these things and in ways that just make it so you can leave this podcast with some exceptional skills and a deeper understanding of yourself and perhaps your pattern with your partners or your exes, and it will just inform you. And I'm so excited because it's so applicable. So before we dive into today's episode, please, wherever you listen to this, make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss one. We've got exceptional podcast episodes coming up. And please share it if this episode resonates with you. And if you can, if you could leave a 5-star review and a written review, that's super, super helpful to get it in more people's ears. So without further ado, here is Nick Solacek. I cannot wait for you to hear this one. It's a zinger. This man that I have in front of me, but maybe in your ear, is not just a good friend, but also an incredible teacher in relationships. His passion, although I don't want to speak for him, you'll get to speak in a second. Okay. You speak when you're spoken to. You might want to give me some coaching on that one. He's an incredible teacher to couples. His primary focus is in that. And I've just had the honor of watching you grow and teach and speak. And it's been nothing short of inspiring. So Nick, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I don't want to, because, you know, Nick Solacek, but how do you actually, is that like, what's the traditional pronunciation if we were to really get into it?
Yeah. Solacek.
Solacek.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Texan slang version of it.
Well, a lot of people think that I'm American because of the way that I pronounce certain words, but Solacek, we'll go with that.
I like it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Dude, flew in to Vegas for this conversation. Well, that sounds like rock star. Flew into Vegas for this conversation. This is how important this conversation is, people. Truly.
Well, I was definitely not going to turn down the opportunity to talk about relationships with you, who have inspired me and obviously thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions at this point of people. And you know, it's an honor to be here with you. But there's been some incredible guests on this show and pioneers in their field and really accomplished people. So it's like, I'm humbled, privileged to be here.
You're in good company and you were part of that company.
Thank you.
Yeah, like what inspired your work? Because I think for so many people listening, I think being in a relationship in any kind is, can we just say, fucking kind of hard sometimes, a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Especially with parents. But it's really especially romantically. So I'm curious, what inspired you to really want to obsess mainly about that? Because you could coach and teach about so many things, but you really chose a specific space.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of teachers identify with the adage, you teach what you need to learn.
Yeah.
And so for me, I have a lot to learn and had a lot to learn about relationships. Mm. And I found that a lot of my relationships didn't make it past a 10 or 12 month mark. And there were some avoidant patterns and there was just a real lack of understanding about how to make relationships actually work. So some of the primary beliefs I had were relationships end in a, you know, burning, flaming car crash. Marriage is a bad idea. Don't do that.
Don't do that.
And, you know, best to maybe just not get too involved, right? Don't get too vulnerable or open your heart too much because it's going to end badly. So you can see how, obviously, with that set of beliefs that I had, that nothing really would go that well because it affects the way that you sort. It affects the way you see yourself in relationships. Your vision can be a little bit distorted. And you have to actually avoid some of those truths about your beliefs in order to get into the dating pool, you know? Because if you just tell people, hey, I don't believe this is going to work, so let's,
right,
you know,
let's explore this thing that might not get anywhere.
Yeah.
I feel like we could start a recovery group for this specific pattern. It's like, I feel a lot of resonance to the pattern you're speaking of, you know, what's interesting about that pattern is I find that my self-protective mechanism was that they just weren't a good fit. And although that is true, based on what I experienced and based on where my self-awareness was at the time, I found that a lot of the upper limits I hit relationally with people who really could love me, as soon as there was like too much intimacy or too much emotional intimacy, I was like, maybe faster than Usain Bolt. I mean, that's a stretch. Let's be honest. I'm about half the height of him, but yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally get that. I personally feel that there's somatically something I'm beginning to understand about myself and about others is that there's this capacity actually to take love in, to actually be able to receive it and to hold space for that. kind of like holding space for money in a bank account. It's just holding space right. for a certain amount of energy. And all the things that are confronting about relationships that, that make them so hard. So there's a lot of propaganda out there. And you've talked about this before on your podcast and in your work that we're kind of have this distortion about what love is and what relationships look and feel like. Like the whole honeymoon idea that you mm-hmm. meet someone, you know, you get all the dating stuff right. You ask the right questions, you choose each other, and then this you reach the finish line and you get married and it's like, you're good.
I know you now.
Self-actualized.
Right.
And what everyone encounters and experiences is that that's not the case, that they come up against a lot of stuff. Childhood, how to deal with conflict, how to express themselves in a way that isn't overly critical or negative, how to get our needs met, how to deal with the difficult feelings and real fears and terrifying stuff that we actually might be coming up for us. We're not even aware that we're terrified.
Right.
So it's deeply complicated. And because of my struggles in relationship, it motivated me to learn more and get curious and ask questions. And eventually I got involved with Imago relationship theory and really got into the weeds with the psychotherapeutic approach and that model.
I love that model.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through specific model?
At a high level, Imago is Latin for image. And essentially all of us have this image. You can think of it as a silhouette of these two people, which are your primary caretakers. Now, some people have multiple primary caretakers or step parents or foster parents, lots of different configurations. But the point is your imago is this image of the positive and negative traits of your primary caretakers. And Harville Hendricks and Helen Hunt, who wrote Getting the Love You Want, basically,
such a good book.
Yeah, you know, they discovered in their therapeutic work over the last 30, 40 years that their clients found that there was this level of charge and attraction to people that match this image, your imago. So if you're in a difficult relationship, you know, free of abuse, but just difficult relationship, you find it challenging, you're both in a growth work, you're trying to work through all these things that are coming up. There's a phrase, you know, you probably met your imago match, which is this person that challenges you in all of these ways.
That's interesting. It's playing on that you've met your match.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which we would, I think the natural tendency is this isn't working. This, and it isn't in its current iteration. This isn't working. They're not a good match. We fight about the same shit. We can't, which I feel like is every couple, you know, really on some level till you learn how to navigate that space. Like, so what do you do when you recognize you met your match, which you likely did if you're listening and you're like, oh, that feels like me. It is you. It's, what do you do?
Well, there's a few key opportunities. And when you think about enlightenment in life or staying awake, part of that practice and a practical level day to day is when there's a difficult feeling that comes up. You're upset, you're stressed, you're triggered by someone, something they've done, said, something they didn't say, something they didn't do, is to acknowledge, okay, there's a feeling here. What's this about? Let me label that. And is there some historical context to this?
Yeah.
Is there something from my family system this also reminds me of that's giving it this charge and this power, you know, from, it's almost like coming from the back end out of your view. Mm. And just noticing that and noticing that this person you're in relationship with is not the only reason that you're feeling some pain. You know, there's actually previous wounding and hurt from before. And that tends to dissolve a little bit of the charge in between you and the other person. And it helps restore empathy when you learn how to communicate about it. And that's what Imago practitioners do, is teach people how to communicate with one another in a dialogue format, which uses sentence stems. So, you know, right now it's like you and me in a dyad, and I'll be given certain stems to work through and process what's coming up. So communication really, at the end of the day, a lot of the world's conflicts and issues boil down to communication issues. And those happen in relationships for a number of reasons. So people learning practical tools, not just vague concepts or like, you know, complicated psychotherapeutic terms, but really like, okay, I can do this right now to to process this difficult feeling, to have this difficult conversation with my partner. And what this boils down to ultimately for people is facing everything. So facing everything in your relationship, you can think of that as turning towards.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
So there's a number of issues that come up for everybody. Some people's relationships are more highly charged, some less so. Some people have reoccurring fights and patterns and things that they know are core issues. And those core issues are 100% when they're, you know, 2, 3, 4 times the argument's repeating, it's almost always 100% about childhood. So.
That's an important truth.
Yeah.
Because I think that speaks to what you said earlier, which what reduces the charge and the recognition of meeting your match is honoring the familiarity of the emotional need or like the trigger, and then recognizing when you're saying like, when it has this sort of historical momentum, you know, I think it's from, I forget who said it, but it's, if it's hysterical, it's historical,
yeah.
You know, and I think it's Hendricks and Hunt who say that something like 95% of conflicts are not actually about the current conflict.
Yeah, you're never fighting like about what you're fighting about. It's always
something beautiful about that, because there's like less, I'm not as angry about the toilet seat being, I'm never angry that the toilet seat's up. Let's just, that was a bad example. Someone else might get upset if they fall in the toilet at 2 a.m., but it's not about that generally.
Yeah.
Right. And I think we don't hear that. We hear the constant criticisms, which really, you know, I remember hearing Esther Perel saying that behind every criticism is a desired behavior, but we're mostly modeled how to criticize. You never, you always, you didn't, you, we're not modeled how to actually make the request.
Yeah.
Because the way that we observed connection was through criticism. So not to derail or I'd like to bring it back to, okay, so you're in this moment, you're recognizing the, it's actually about something else behind. Yeah. Now what?
When you can share from a place of personal ownership, it tends to dissolve and remove the other person's sense of being blamed or attacked or criticized. So if I can say that, you know, hey, would love to talk with you, is now a good time? And I get consent that it's appropriate for me to...
consent for a conversation.
Right.
Yeah, so I want to be this, more important than the football game, more important than the,
yeah.
You know?
One of my mentors says it like this, and it's a kind of a crude example, but if I asked you to piss your pants right now, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't do it. You'd make a mess of the carpet.
That's a great example.
You got to wash your pants. It's embarrassing. It's a hassle. You got to go back to your place and change. But people do this, and they do it in an energetic sense, is they might take a crap in the middle of the living room because they felt like they wanted to. My point about that is when we're young, we are potty trained. We learn there's an appropriate time and place to go. It's easier. It's cleaner. It doesn't make a mess. It's more appropriate. It doesn't leave a big stink in the room.
Right.
And for couples in their conflict, it's the same thing. It's like, just because you want to go right now and you want to have it out doesn't mean it's a good time to do it. You got to learn how to have that conversation. And in a way that doesn't create more of a mess inside of your relationship.
Yeah.
And that is often a hard thing to do when we're upset. The great metaphor is if you're walking on the beach on a sunny day, and let's say you spend a couple $1,000 to go to Mexico and everything's fantastic, and you're walking through the sand and there's some, you know, broken shells, and you step on one, you cut your toe. All of your energy and attention goes right to the wound. You're checking if you're bleeding, if everything's okay. You're, you know, you're totally self-absorbed in that moment. And in relationships, that happens emotionally. We get injured, we feel hurt by the person, and then we get totally self-absorbed into, you know, our own situation, and we become defensive. And that's a big problem, because as soon as we get defensive, we're in this tennis match with our partner, and we're flinging insults or negativity or criticisms or just defensive statements back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge issue, because it really erodes the sense of safety between two people. And that's one of the core things that really couples need to get. So maybe I can just talk about that a little bit in terms of how I define that. Harville Hendricks says that couples essentially need two things, safety and aliveness. And when I think about that, I'm like, okay, well, what is safety? Mm-hmm. I think, well, I grew up in a safe household. Like, there was no crime. There was food in the fridge. We had gifts under the tree. My parents helped out, took us to sports, and they were present and together and around. Mm-hmm. But that's actually not really what safety is. And so I just quickly define this as five things. Attunement, the ability to repair, truthfulness, integrity, and consistency and reliability.
Attunement, so the ability to be connected, be present.
Yeah. So let me define
more to that. Yeah.
So attunement is like, I get you. Mm. I feel that I get you. And you feel in your body that I get it. We're attuned.
Is there a part of, and if you don't, you're curious about getting.
That's right. Okay. I demonstrate curiosity. So we got relaxation in the like relational field. And I'm going to hang in there long enough, like Dan Siegel calls that contingency. I'm going to hang in there long enough with you to understand instead of being like really dismissive or be like, okay, whatever, am I here?
I'm going to hang in with you long enough in the discomfort, the uncomfortable space of not getting you yet. And I speak from my own experience here. Part of the challenge that I had in not getting them, and maybe this is in socialization as a man, is I felt in some sort of way a failure, or like I wasn't enough to understand them. And also just how hard language is to like, and I'm not being the martyr here for men, but so much of male conditioning is you're not good at talking about your feelings. That's just how men are. Mm. And in a way, when you look at like the research on when babies are dressed in blue or pink, and then people are told they're boys or girls, how they treat them right away is completely different.
Yeah.
And then that leads to developmental differences, potentially neurological developmental differences based on testosterone and estrogen. Mm-hmm. But like, what's interesting about that is when I'm in relationship as an adult and my whole life, and this could be true for any gender or anything in between, because it could be true individually. And I'm being asked to find language. My partner wants emotional connection from me. But yet, like, the world has taught me that I don't have connection to emotionality. Mm. And so, like, what I've always thought about, one of the greatest challenges as men, I know you do men's work too, so curious your thoughts on this, is the thing our partner most needs from us, regardless of the gender combination, is the very thing that we've been told has nothing to do with masculinity or is in some way in opposition to masculinity. Mm. And so I have to rebel and revolt against the model of masculinity to find connection.
Yeah.
But I also have to find language that in some ways I've been told to never use because you're a pussy, you're this, you're that, whatever it is. And that's why I think like the act of emotional intelligence, not in business because we'll find it there, but actually in romantic relationship, is such an act of revolution against what is the traditional models. Curious your thoughts on that. And then, of course, I want to get back to the other definitions.
Yeah, we'll come back to safety. I think what builds upon what you're saying there is that the thing that your partner needs the most from you in upset, in stress, in conflict is usually the hardest thing for you to give them.
Well, that's a fucking conundrum.
It is. But the key there is that it's a growth opportunity.
Right.
And when couples learn that paradigm, that conflict is growth trying to happen, and they take that on and start to become aware of it in the moment.
Yeah. Conflict is growth trying to happen.
Yeah. So I get to say, instead of like, oh, you always do this, you're ruining my life. You're just like
your mom, insert parent. Your dad. Yeah.
You say, okay, wow. Like I might feel like I hate what's happening right now. And there's a growth opportunity here. Instead of
and take some humble pie.
Totally. But instead of the shameful thoughts that a lot of couples have, actually most couples have, which is, you know, this should be easier for us. Why can't we figure this out? How come we haven't worked through this yet? You know, why isn't therapy working? You know, how many more books do I have to read? Just kind of like this feeling like the struggle, feeling the lack of worth, the lack of ability, what you were speaking to earlier. And that's a really tough place to be. But the struggle is normal and it's necessary. It's necessary for each person in the relationship to grow and to reclaim parts of themselves that were lost, frozen, disowned along the way. And it's temporary. It doesn't have to go on like this forever. And ultimately what couples find is once they start practicing and doing couples work, they might transcend certain patterns and they're going to grow and they're going to expand. They're going to encounter new challenges, new issues, new problems they've never had to face before.
New opportunities.
New opportunities. Exactly.
I like it.
So in Imago theory, there's kind of a running joke, AFGO, which is another fucking growth opportunity.
And that's
always, because they're just reoccurring. They're going to come up. You're going to be challenged. But that's a very different paradigm from, you know, that honeymoon idea and the propaganda about, you know, what love
Disney
is supposed to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. So as you, because I've experienced this with Kylie, it's like as you surpass, expand, develop the skills that are necessary to move beyond that one sort of upper limit, and then that becomes the new floor you're standing upon, and then you're getting more depth and intimacy. And ultimately, I think we get to a place where the tools are not out in the world everywhere, because not everyone, 99% of couples don't actually make it past that one recurring thing. And they don't see their partner as an invitation to their expansion. They don't see conflict as a growth opportunity. And so you like are actually building the plane as you're flying, you know, in some ways, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which I think is cool, because you start to see that your relationship is actually this container where you expand, they expand, and the connection itself then can be seen as this sacred container for growth. Like, what an honor.
Yeah.
You know, I said to Kai the other day, like, I wouldn't pick another person in the world to be going through all the things that we've navigated, and especially in the last couple of years. And she was like, so outside of the pandemic? And I was like, yeah, that too. I was like, yeah, like, especially during something like a pandemic.
Yeah.
Like, wow, what a thing to try to co-regulate through with the, you know, the sensitivities of the world, the fragility of communication.
Yeah.
So safety, speaking of safety, because really that is, there's like not a collective experience of safety in the grand, but there is in within certain communities that we create and shared conversations. So if we're going, so we defined attunement, and then what were the other ones?
So I'll go through them quickly. So attunement, we define that. Integrity, actions matching words. So you're the kind of person that does what you say you're going to do.
Okay.
And you don't commit to things. You don't say you're going to do something if you can't do it. And that's really important. It's about keeping
agreements.
Seems
to be a big one.
It's huge.
That might be one of the main ones.
I would argue that, you know, integrity is just one of the most powerful things for people in relationship, but especially for leaders, and whether they're coaches or therapists or healers of any kind. Just showing up in that way, just doing what you say you're going to do.
Being what you ask.
And nobody's perfect, right? So we're allowed to make mistakes, which is why the ability to repair is part of this model of safety, which really means that I'm willing and open to repair attempts, to apologize, to receive apology, to forgive, to seek understanding, versus being quickly dismissive and writing people off if they make a mistake.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah. And prioritizing repair over less important things like video games or Netflix or the football game, and making sure those conversations happen in a timely manner. So those are the first three. And these aren't in any particular order of importance. They're all important. But consistency and reliability is also a big one. And what that means is no Jekyll and Hyde behavior, showing up in a relatively consistent way. Mm. Is this someone you can count on to a high degree? You kind of rely on them. And that shows up in behavior, obviously, in the way that we speak, act, the way we show up in a relationship, the way we show up in stressful moments, the way we, show up at morning for work, when we come home for dinner. Most of us in the coaching world anyway have probably working for laptops for a long time and are part of this, laptop right. class. So we have another challenge about working from home, maybe being with our partner all the time, which many couples have had to deal with through the pandemic. And so many of the teachings from the 80s and 90s were about making quality time with your partner, make plans to see them. You got to spend that. And quality time is still important. But now people have been just jammed together at home. It's like, geez, I just needed a weekend off.
It lost its quality.
So it won't lose the thread here. The last one there is truthfulness. And truthfulness is really about us coming from a sincere place. Mm-hmm. So there's no lying or deceit or betrayal. And there's a sense of transparency. So if people can practice these pillars and begin to embody them, each person, if they show up in this way, it's really hard to get 100% safety all the time. So I don't want to create some idea that that's reasonable for you to do day to day, but it's a safe enough kind of holding environment for the relationship. And when you got that foundation, you can begin to work on the pillars and keep yourself accountable and evaluate, hey, how am I showing up in
like
these areas?
Out of these pillars.
Yeah.
I would imagine that for the couple to do that, both have to be aware of this need and both have to be committed to it. Like there has to be some sense, like I find one person will often read the book or do the thing. And then they're like, I'll just start to insert these things into our relational life. And certainly that can change things because yeah. one side of the pattern changes. But if like both people aren't committed to this sort of sacred fertilizing of the base of the relationship, then like one's committed to integrity, truth, attunement, you know, it needs to be conscious, doesn't it? Like this conscious intention, this conscious shared desire.
Yeah, absolutely. Your relationship is only as safe as your partner feels.
Mm.
So just think about it. Your relationship is only as safe as your partner feels. So if your partner's saying, I feel unsafe, I don't like this, this makes me very uncomfortable, you know, one type of person might say, well, you know, whatever, you need to deal with that. That's your shit.
Oof.
But what you're missing is your partner's actually saying, I feel unsafe. And safety is really the doorway and the portal to which we connect. Dogs don't play with humans that they don't feel safe with. Kids don't play with kids they don't feel safe with. Adults don't play. Adults aren't vulnerable and playful and lighthearted with people they don't feel safe with. You know, for the most part.
When you put it that way, it's such a simple instinctual necessity.
Yeah, but we're not taught about these things that are not emphasized. And in certain family homes and many family systems, if you look at your situation, you probably didn't have safety in the way that I'm describing it. So how do you know what it feels like? How do you know how to embody that? And how does it become like a natural way of being? And there's certainly a lot of challenges. I love what Dr. Alexandra Solomon says. You know, if your partner asks you to go to couples therapy, go the first time, like go the first time they ask you, because the partner's saying like, hey, there's something I want to work out here. This doesn't feel good to me.
That's such a commitment to the couple. And I think what's interesting from the person who's being asked is in my experience, there's often a fear of what might be uncovered and maybe like there's like a anticipatory experience of shame that makes us not want to go because, it, you know, simply asked most couples, and I think if the answer is no, you should probably break up, but like most couples, if you're like, hey, would you like to work through and figure out how to navigate this cycle that you do so that you can feel like communication is less fraught, less friction, you know, frictionful, I don't know, whatever the word is.
Yeah.
They would say yes.
Mm.
And if they don't, like if someone doesn't want to work through something, you can't fucking do it. Like that's, I think that's one of the most challenging sort of things to acknowledge or confront or accept is I made this request. The other person said no. I made the request again. And I remember in reading the research on when people get divorced, it's women who initiate divorce far more than men.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is necessarily shocking. You know, they tend to be a more accurate barometer of sort of relational health. And I think there's a lot of evolutionary reasons for that. Mm. And it's about 2 years from the day the first like, hey, we should go do this thing, till they walk out the door, no matter the side or the gender. And by then it's like, they're gone, you know? And then we're like, fuck, I'll go to therapy now.
Right.
Well, I'll read the book. I'll change.
Yeah.
And then integrity. It's like, are you changing to get me back? Are you changing because you know, change is important. And then the outcome of that is relational success, which I think is because we often change to get something. which the motivation can be there. Mm. Like the reason can be, you gave me feedback. I see I hurt you. I'm going to change.
Yeah.
But if I'm only changing on the condition I get to keep you, then as soon as you leave, that's probably gone.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's something I'm thinking about as you're describing this, and it goes back to childhood in terms of the early journey between 0 and 7.
Yeah.
And there are some key things going on there around attachment and exploration and identity and competence that inform the way that people respond to stuff. And if you've ever heard the term maximizers and minimizers, there's these essentially these ways people express themselves. And a great kind of example is that everything in the universe is pulsing and vibrating. And we have our own expression of that, our own pulse, our own vibration, your own vibe. And we're often attracted to someone who has an opposite style to us. And the way that that is built, and what people need to understand, what this is built upon, this communication style, is terror and wound and hurt. So, for example,
tell us more about that.
If you grow up with a caretaker who is inconsistently available and cold, there is a wound there that gets developed for the child and a subsequent fear. And what that fear is annihilation, right? That I'm going to die because mom and dad or God, I have to attach to them to survive. I'm not able to take care of myself. And there's this biological imperative to survive matched with a hurt and fear that maybe you won't. And so there's adaptations that get created, like isolating and detaching. So I have to protect myself. I shouldn't get attached to this person. They're not there all the time. They're not consistent. And when they are around, they're really cold. And I'm worried I'm not going to get taken care of. There's all different ways this forms. So if you have a parent who's controlling, smothering, dominating, you might develop a rigid personality because you have to be to maintain a sense of your own identity. Or you might avoid or
create space.
Yeah, create space because you don't want to get controlled or smothered. So without going too deep into all the specific examples, essentially there's the way I like to describe this is there's a yellow brick road that runs through childhood and it continues on into our youth. And there's all kinds of troubles that people need to navigate. Some people travel that yellow brick road relatively unscathed and they have a great childhood experience. While others, they venture off into the woods a little bit and they end up sliding down, you know, either side of this road that I'm describing. And what's happening there is there's hurt in childhood. There's wounds that get created in subsequent fears. And the more you experience that, the more you get driven towards one of two styles, maximizing or minimizing.
Yeah.
And those two people, they fall in love.
They love each other.
They love each other. Opposites attract. The way Esther Perel says this is one person comes out of childhood desiring more freedom. And the other type comes out desiring more stability, more commitment. And those two people find each other and fall in love.
Of course, right?
So
the invitation to heal.
Yeah. And so this creates a number of issues because when one person's stressed, when they're upset, when they're angry, they express it in a very different way from their partner. And each person's style, each person's way of being doesn't make any sense to the other person. Because like, why do you deal with things this way? What is your problem? Why can't you be more like me? Why can't you see the world the way that I see it?
Oh, isn't that so true? The sort of like martyrdom of our own perceptions of relational, what is important in that moment.
Yeah.
One person's, what's important is reconnection and the other person is space.
Yeah.
In some sense. Interesting, the overlap with attachment theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. That's what I love about relational organization schemas is they're different ways of understanding our patterns. And so maximizers and minimizers find each other, which is this in the same sort of breath or language as you've met your match?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
What an opportunity.
Yes.
Right.
So there's some key opportunities and it might make sense just to describe. I find that people, it really clicks for them when they find out what a minimizer is.
Yeah. How do you know what you are?
So some general things you can look for and notice in yourself and notice in your partner. And we never use knowledge of this kind as a weapon, We use
you're
it as
such a fucking maximizer.
We use it as an opportunity to grow and to.
I want to know what I am. I can't wait.
All right,
tell me. Yeah.
So, minimizers tend to withhold. They tend to avoid attention. So the whole pulsing, vibrating thing in upset, in tension, in conflict is to minimize. So it's kind of a constriction. It can be like turtle going into the shell.
Right.
Quiet, keeping things to oneself. I'm going to figure this out on my own. I don't need other people. The withholding, withdrawing sort of sense.
I feel like that's more Kai.
Okay. Well, the maximizer has more of, I'm responsible for making this relationship work. We need to talk about this right now.
Yeah. Wait, who's that?
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I want to talk about everything. And there can be some sense of urgency, and there can be just actually an openness and a willingness to talk to anybody about it, to get a second opinion. And these two expressions are opposite. One person's, you know, the storm on the mountain, hurtling lightning bolts. And the other person's just like going into their shell, like, oh, and both people are just trying to get safety. Both people are just trying to protect themselves from those fears that they have from childhood, from their early attachment, early development.
That's beautiful. So when I think about the five things then that would become, that are important for safety, in that moment where I'm seeking to repair, because that's ultimately what the like shooting lightning bolts coming, maximizing is attempting, and the other person's maybe seeking space to then possibly repair. Like in order to regulate, I seek connection. In order to regulate, they seek isolation a little more, or sovereign self, time with self. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's really, there's just sort of a self-protective mechanism there. So it can be like, I don't want to be abandoned. I don't want to be neglected. I don't want to feel like I'm not being heard. I don't want to feel invisible. Yeah. And then the other person feels, I don't want to be controlled. I don't want to be smothered. I don't want to be dominated. Get off of me. I don't want to be made to feel guilty, you know, for this. And it makes sense. You know, no one deserves to have those experiences, but our fears are also not always reality. It's like, is our partner, just because they went to their room and closed the door and they're reading a book for 3 hours avoiding the conflict, is it really that we're going to be abandoned? Are they really going to leave? Mm-hmm. Or is this actually just a terror that lives in my body from, you know, some, there's a historical context. And there's just the feeling that I just want this relationship to work. And if they go to their room all the time like this and isolate, maybe it is going to end. Maybe, you know, my fears will come true. So there's a couple opportunities. For the minimizers, the opportunities are actually about being more present. Minimizers can appear calm, cool, and collected. But under the surface, there can be the same kind of anxious energy or storm raging. So for the minimizer to be more present, to open up more, to say something like, oh, I feel this, or I notice when you said that, I felt this way. This sort of taking ownership of emotions and letting their partner in a little bit on their internal experience. Mm-hmm. That's the growth opportunity. And for the maximizer, the growth opportunity is to back off a little bit more, to contain more of your experience. That doesn't mean not talking about things, but it means just backing off a little bit. And the urgency that you feel to talk about it right then in that moment, maybe you make an appointment with your partner to, hey, I'd love to talk about this tonight or tomorrow. When are you available? Couples need to create agreements about what that time frame is going to be. So maximizer, again, containing, backing off more, giving a little bit of breathing room and space to the other person. And that, when people emphasize that and they start to practice and notice this, it tends to make a little bit of a difference.
Yeah.
But this is what I mean about facing everything, is facing these issues that come up and turning towards them and turning, you know, partners turning towards each other to say, wow, you know, I really feel this way. And you know, I notice I need some space right now and I care about you and I love you, but can we talk about this in 30 minutes? I think I need to go for a walk and just kind of center myself, because I'm feeling really activated or I'm feeling really upset and I want to have this conversation from a little bit more of a grounded place. I mean, imagine if people talk to each other that way. And
that's safety right there.
Right. Because I'm being truthful.
I will be back.
Yeah. Being truthful and then actually coming back.
Right.
Being an
integrity
person.
Yeah.
And attuned. You know, hey, soon. I know this is when important
I'm here,
to you.
I'm present.
Yeah.
That experience of empathy, connection. Oh my God, like how much repair just exists through that statement for self too, because if I'm someone who normally minimized or shut down, and I feel like I've sort of slid down both sides of that fucking road.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's really interesting to think that even that statement is such a lean in for someone who normally would maybe withdraw. And for you listening, you might think of it as avoidance.
Yeah.
And I remember I just did a recent podcast with Sarah Baldwin, who's a somatic expert. She's unreal. And she was saying, like, for the person who is more anxiously attached, exactly what you're saying, like taking that space and learning to self-regulate, and the other person who takes more space, the more avoidant, the minimizer, actually learning how to lean into co-regulation, because that's the fear, is the regulation with other. Yeah. They don't trust. And I love these overlaps of ways of healing. Because I think without the somatic work, really, what you're saying is somatic work. Mm. It is the like increasing my capacity for whatever is my edge.
Yeah.
And so when I try to sort of bring in what you first said about who we tend, our match tends to sort of elicit the same desires, emotional need that we're not getting from, let's say, our main partner. Is similar to a primary caregiver that we had. Mm-hmm. So I have that model. And then how I respond to that, I'm like being re-injured by my match to then have to make me stretch to my edge, and then also make my match stretch to their edge, because you said the hardest thing, the thing our partner wants most is the thing that's hardest for us to give. And so if we can understand from a compassionate lens that we injure our partner in a way that's familiar, they injure us in a way that's familiar, by navigating conflict differently than the way that we originally had it modeled or patterned or what we observed, we actually begin to build new skills. Mm-hmm. And the relationship we can heal beyond, in some way, is that fair? The like template that we experienced with this parent, or what we observed in our family tree, which I think if you look up your family tree, you're just going to see the exact same or a similar thing over and over again. And I think that's what's so cool, is like you start to, for the first time, lean in and you're like, this is the first time someone's fucking done this in my whole family tree. Like, that's why when you said that historical, the fear of annihilation, right? Like that word has so much to it, because it should, because in the eyes of a 2-year-old, that's actually it.
Yeah.
And so it gives some beautiful context. Like, I love the way you're explaining it, because when you're in that moment and you're like, I just want to get through this, but the like emotionality of the abandoned, whatever it might be, 2-year-old, 7-year-old, abused, whatever it is, there's just so much there that it, at least when you have understanding, this mutual understanding of what's been occurring, I just feel like you can sort of exhale in some way. Does that make sense?
For sure. Yeah. Well, it's a bit of a relief when these things make sense.
Right.
When you have a terrifying feeling in your body, but you don't understand it, and you can't label it, you're not sure exactly what it is and where it comes from, there's a lot of uncertainty associated with that. So, you know, the anxiety continues, or it escalates to panic, or you go really deep into certain adaptations, which is just, you know, these self-protecting mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Because you don't have the awareness yet to notice that, oh, I feel I didn't get invited to the team, or that person, you know, wanted me to sit out on this match. I didn't get invited to dinner, and that made me feel really unwanted. And like, oh, did I feel unwanted in parts of my childhood experience? Oh, yeah, I did. And so, you know, so that takes a little bit of the power away from really this energy that's behind sometimes blaming or criticizing or seeing other people as the pure source of your pain. There's
there's like a
historical
army.
Context.
Like a bunch of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's part of the turning towards the truth.
Yeah.
Making the relationship a safe space for previous truths to come forward and be healed.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I want to understand two things. One, what do you mean by aliveness? Because you said safety and aliveness, right? Yeah. Are the two things. And then can we maybe walk through, for you listening, what a dialogue or how to get into dialogue, Imago dialogue sounds like.
Sure.
So aliveness, yeah.
Let's clarify what aliveness is. I would define this as five things. Five pillars.
Five it up.
Purpose, presence, playfulness, positivity, and passion.
Individually and collectively?
So these five pillars are connected and they relate to each other in a certain way, but these are really about aliveness, about bringing aliveness back to the relationship or nurturing it, nourishing it. Passion covers our joy in life, sexuality, our hobbies, interests. That's that sense of vitality and zest.
Adventure.
Get out of bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, purpose is a cause, you know, something that you are about and there's a chief aim in life. Presence is commonly used, you know, about being present in the here and now, the fountain of well-being, just here, being with another person. And that can be really hard for many people because we live in such a fast-paced culture, at least in the West. I think I can speak for most countries when I say that. But social media, shortening attention spans, our attention is divided and distracted in many ways. So actually being present is quite a wonderful thing. And when you are in the here and now and present, you're kind of, you feel alive.
Yeah.
You're not in the past thinking about regret. You're not in the future worrying or thinking anxiously or, you know, plotting. You're just here. So playfulness and positivity are the other two. And playfulness is that sense of lightheartedness, that sense of not always taking everything too seriously. Mm. It's good to take yourself seriously, but it's also good to be able to laugh, let things go. And there's a lot of scientific evidence that suggests that playfulness is just a really important thing for relationships and for their longevity.
Really important for repair too, isn't it?
Very
like
important.
Humor.
Yeah, being
not
able to laugh
avoidance,
at yourself.
But like not using, because I've definitely used humor to sort of deflect, not have to deal with shit.
Mm-hmm.
But now I've sort of learned how to, once I got called forward by my lovely fiance, early in our relationship, it what was a survival strategy, really, so I could fit in, so I could be funny, so I could belong, has, instead of a way of sort of protecting myself, but also giving me significance, it's now become such a shared way of cultivating joy within even the sticky parts, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that clarification. Positivity is the last one.
Mm.
And positivity is really powerful and it's important. And positivity can be like being able to reframe negative events, not like toxic positivity where you deny suffering or you deny difficult challenges that you've faced or going to face or currently dealing with, but positive in the context that, you know, I'm gonna get through this and we can work through this. And there's kind of this global sense of like, it's going to be okay, you know? And that's just a great foundation. And the Gottmans have proved that you really need a ratio of positivity to negativity to feel that sense of joy and fulfillment and satisfaction in your relationship. So that's how I would classify aliveness. And five pillars for aliveness and five for safety makes it easy, makes a perfect wheel, which I've got, wheel of relationship, which I give to couples. And it's a self-evaluation, just like the wheel of life that a lot of facilitators use to get a sense of where people think that they're at and identify growth opportunities.
So when you're thinking about aliveness, I'd imagine not only are you thinking about those pillars in the context of you and your partner, but I would imagine those are also, like, do you think about it first from the individual? Or do you think about it like my playfulness, my purpose, my, or the relationships collective?
So great question. So it's really important that the individuals feel these, like a sense of purpose, for example, but also that the relationship has a purpose. So that's really, you know, about relationship vision and two people co-creating something. A great way to do a relationship vision is for each partner to write down all the ways that they really want to see the relationship. And I want this kind of sex life. I want this kind of bank account. I want to feel this way in the morning. I want to live in these places. I want X amount of kids. really describing the lifestyle elements, the location, the feel, the whole tone of your life. Mm-hmm. And when each person does that, that you don't just jam the two together and just make one big list. You actually exchange lists, and each partner can go down and say, oh yeah, this is, I agree with this. I agree with this. I want this. And the similarities, you develop a relationship vision from that. And the things that are different, those become topics for dialogue. Those become topics for conversation.
So we'll just segue for understanding. Yeah.
So we'll just segue to, you know, what you asked is, hey, what would a dialogue be like? What would it actually be like to practice an Imago dialogue? And the first thing that we'll do, and I do this with all the couples that I work with, because we're always practicing in session, training for the real world scenario where, you know, sometimes you're on the battlefield in a relationship. You right. find yourselves
you
in
need
these
this model.
Difficult. Yeah.
I find what's interesting about Imago dialogue, and I know the Gottmans have similar sort of framework, that they are based off how countries handle conflict. Like, well, some are not using it currently, but, you know, like how we would hope that conflict resolution is done. And what I love about Imago dialogue is, although it sounds, I think its structure can feel sort of clinical our experience of it can feel rigid. Mm-hmm. It's so important because it gives language and a framework that we can move through much quicker once the couple navigates mastery. But if you've never had the actual tools of like A, B, C, D, E, and you're just always going to Z, which Z is fuck you, or Z is hang up, or Z is critical, or whatever it is, this really allows you to heal so much through this structure. So I'm really excited for people to hear it.
So there's a couple important things.
Yeah.
Basically, the setup is that there's a sender and a receiver, and those are not fixed positions. They will rotate, and one person might need to send a frustration or send a appreciation or to talk about a caring behavior that they really want to see more of. And there's a number of different dialogues, but the point is here is one person's a sender and they say, hey, I'd like to make an appointment with you, or I'd love to talk in 30 minutes.
I really like the appointment.
Yeah. Are you available? Is now a good time? And what that does is it's honoring boundaries. Saying that just because I want to do this right now, remember psychic potty training, just because I want to go right now doesn't mean it's a good time for you. So get the consent. And if it's a no, I'm going to accept that. Okay, you're not available right now. And the partner needs to say, this is when.
This is when. Okay.
And in a reasonable time frame, not like
what's
we're
reasonable?
Talking 6 months.
I say 24 hours.
24 hours,
is
I think
what
is
you
great.
Come up with?
For some people's lifestyles, they might say 48 hours.
That's a long time to sit on something. I think the like maximizer in me is like, don't you fucking do that.
Right.
Don't you try 48. I'll fucking come for you.
Yes.
Cut you.
So there's this kind of sense of trust that gets built when someone requests a conversation, a dialogue, and the other person honors that appointment and shows
the integrity
up.
Of the integrity. Yeah.
So that's how all these setups start. And I practice it, even though couples have done it before with me in sessions, we start that way just to pattern that thing. Okay. I'm supposed to ask, not just assume
so
that
good.
I want to talk to you right now about this. So we're doing it.
Which is generally how it works, you know, is like, oh, I find it's funny because it's like in the climax of the movie while you're deep in some work, it's the goal line in a football game. It's when your partner's on a trip. You know, it's like, I think sometimes the attempt at dialogue is a test to see if we're important enough. And we have to like remove that sort of test away from it, because if they say, no, I'm not available. Because most people, if you don't have that deadline of, let's say it's 24 or 48 hours, where then the person requesting has to learn how to self-regulate and the other person's learning how to lean in. If you don't have it, some people will be like, yeah, I can't talk right now. But like in 5 years when shit really blows up, we'll dig this one up.
Yeah.
You know, and I really think that's where so much gets swept under the rug, because we're not actually attending to these things that need attention. And, you know, so much of once you navigate these things well, then the relationship really develops, as you know, like the Gottmans talk about, this low tolerance for negativity. Like the relationship, we always think like, oh, I don't want to I don't want to make a mountain out of a molehill. I let things go. And although that's important, it's not if it's self-silencing. It's not if it's self-abandonment. It actually, we then don't have the safety that you're talking about. I can't turn towards my relationship with the things that I'm suffering with within the relationship. Then I go drink shitty ass Chardonnay, which that whole business might be based on. Not that Chardonnay is bad, but you know what I mean? Actually, it is bad. What am I even saying? I don't drink anymore, but if I drank again, it wouldn't be Chardonnay. Yeah. But it's interesting that we then develop these other outlets that are important for emotional sharing. And, you know, there's things that our friends provide that our partner doesn't. But we don't have a place to turn towards. So all that to say, so if you're the sender and you're like, hey, I'd like to make an appointment. I'd like to chat. Do you have time in 30 minutes or now or whatever? And the person's like, yeah. Why don't you come back in 30 minutes or I'll come to you as soon as I'm done wrapping this shit up and I'll come to you. All right. So we have an appointment that's about to happen.
So there's a couple key sentence stems here. And what's important for the sender is that they're taking responsibility for their reality and they're using I statements to talk about, you know, I feel this way. And when I notice this or I see you do that, I feel, right?
Okay.
So essentially what I want to talk to you about is, and you fill in the blank, in the way that I'm suggesting. And in a dialogue process, there's mirroring. So what that means is if I tell you that the sky is orange and I saw pigs flying today and there were 7 tornadoes in the front yard, you're not going to say, that's ridiculous. You're making it up. I don't believe you. You actually say, oh, okay. So what I hear you saying is that the sky, you know, and pigs
orange,
flying.
There's pigs flying, yeah. There's 7 tornadoes.
Because dialogue is not about, attunement to another person is not about agreement. It's about understanding.
Attunement is not about agreement. It's about understanding. Do you hear that?
Yeah.
Do you hear that? Because that is, it's like success, conflict successfully navigated is not agreeing with one another.
Yes.
Right. That's, yeah. I think we all could use that statement regardless of the relationship.
Yeah, it's big. And the experience, the felt sense of being in dialogue when you're doing this properly is that, okay, I'm sending to you and you're actually listening.
Mm.
And that is kind of revolutionary in its own thing.
It really is.
Right? That I'm going to actually talk and you're going to listen. And this is where people get into a lot of trouble and why Harville says that talking is the most dangerous thing that couples do. Because we sometimes talk in monologue or one person walks into one person walks into their partner's office, for example, and says, you left the dishes on the counter again. I told you not to do that. And now it's sort of monologue, talking at and talking down. And then there's inequality.
There's a hierarchy, yeah.
And that's naturally going to send someone into a little bit of a defensive state because they're maybe feeling attacked or criticized. Or
I don't like hierarchy. Condescension?
Yeah.
Trigger.
For sure. Well, for everybody, it's not a good feeling. And this is why the dialogue tries to slow things down. So if you want to go fast in your relationship, you want to make a lot of progress, you got to slow it down. And that's what the dialogue does. It's a trauma-informed process.
Makes you have to regulate.
Yeah.
And you're co-regulating,
yeah,
because of the mirroring.
Yes.
So you say, there's pigs flying, sky is orange, 7 tornadoes. So my reflection is, what I hear you saying,
yes,
is da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And that's it, right? I'm just...
That's it. And then the magic question for you in this dialogue is there more about that?
Oh, yeah. So I'm gathering. So I sum up. Did I get that right? Is there more about that? And then you get to go again.
I say, yeah, you know, and it was raining. And you know, I elaborate. So what's happening there is you with sincerity... Not with, oh, any more you want to tell me about? You
know? Yeah, this could be hard.
Right.
Right. At first, yeah. Especially if there's contempt
for
in
sure.
the relationship.
Yeah. But that's part of this growth edge is actually to turn off your own TV channel. This is why presence is so important. I'm going to turn, you can't really turn off your reality, but just put it aside for a few minutes and to just be with your partner
So beautiful.
Knowing that you're also going to get a chance to share. You're
I
also
bet people are just waiting for that.
Well, in the middle of process, so some people, I can't listen to this anymore, you know? And they have to insert their piece. And they're, you know, they don't totally understand yet that they're really hurting this sort of attunement, this beautiful moment between them and their partner, or this person's just vulnerably sharing and being patient with the mirroring responses if the other person doesn't get it and just hanging in there. And what people tend to get, so what we're talking about here is just safe conversations.
Right.
And this doesn't transcend or solve all the issues that couples have, but it creates a foundation of which, you know, they can actually begin to work on things. And some issues do dissolve and resolve themselves just through actually dialoguing it out. Because the next stems that come from this, it's hard to cover all of the nuances and subtleties of the dialogue. But the sender is going to have a couple sentence stems after, you know, what I want to talk about. Here's the core theme. What hurts me about this is, what I'm afraid of is, what this reminds me of childhood is.
Ooh, okay. What I want to talk to you about is sky is blue or whatever. All that's, well, I just gaslit you. Sky's orange. What a fucking practice makes perfect. How fucking ridiculous. I actually worked with this couple once where we were doing the dialogue, and it's just so funny because she was quite reactionary and he was quite tender and soft. And he was sending. She's like, can I fucking say something? I got something fucking say about that. And I was like, no, you can't. You get to sit and listen. And I remember her just gyrating. But how transformative that was, because he finally was feeling like a bit of emotional safety. I think that's why the interventionist teaching this is so important, because you're actually, in the work you're doing, is you are actually regulating for them. Mm-hmm. And kind of refereeing it. Is that fair to say? Like there's someone modeling safety. Yeah. And regulation.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it this way, sometimes leading session that way is like when you go to disco bowling and they inflate the gutters. And so it's just keeping, you know, the couple in the right direction.
Yeah.
They don't have to be straight, get it perfect, get a strike, but just don't go into just the gutter down. There. Don't right. go into that negativity. Don't go into the blame, the finger pointing, the shaming, the talking down to your partner. Just stay here within these sentence stems. And that makes a big difference. And it's kind of like the training wheels again for the real life to have yeah. these conversations. And the reason going slow gets you results is that when you slow it down and take your time with this and practice it, you begin to quickly identify, because you're going to be talking about the core issues. You're going to be talking about the reoccurring themes.
Right.
So you're going to quickly identify that, oh, like I have these hurts and fears, and I have this childhood memory that's not always present and conscious to me, but is running in the background. And wow, that's a powerful insight. I didn't realize how much energy I had on this subject around the dishes, but it was really about this childhood experience of being not considered and dismissed and not acknowledged. And that also gives the other person a sense of empathy, like, oh, wow, there's context. All this coming yeah. up for you. Wow, I didn't know that. You know, I don't think about that when I just leave my plate on the counter. Okay, well, maybe a growth opportunity for me is to not leave my plate on the counter and to really show up in this different way that begins to contribute to my partner's sense of healing, really. It's like being allies in each other's healing.
Okay, so just so I like for the person listening, and for me, we've got explain what it is. What's the next one?
What I want to talk about is hurt, fear, childhood. So what hurts me about this is, what I'm afraid of is, what this reminds me of from childhood. And you can actually do this by yourself. So if you have a difficult moment, difficult feeling, something happens, your partner does something, or you're at work and your boss says something, or your friend does something, you can actually say, okay, what's this about? What am I hurt by? What am I afraid of? Is there a childhood memory?
Right, does it remind me of?
Yeah.
The feeling, the experience, like the trigger.
Yeah.
How you feel from whatever.
Yeah.
This feels transcendent in some ways, like to have one, that internal sense of awareness, and then to bring that sort of trust and space where you're sharing with your partner these things that your partner's job, you're saying the whole time, is, it's what I hear you saying is this, is there anything else? And then how do you know when you go from one to the next?
You go from one to the next when the sender feels complete.
Is that a request from the listener? Like, do you feel complete with that?
It's really, you know, is there more about that?
Oh, and they say no. Okay.
And they say no. You know, you also want to confirm, you know, did I, when you mirror, we say, oh, you said this, I heard you say that. Did I get that? Do you feel like I've got it? As the sender, you want to feel like, yeah, I feel you get me. You heard me. You know, what you said to me is exactly the way that I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And there's that, you know, that just like attunement in that moment.
Man, this is such a good reminder, because I learned this, you know, years ago. And I forget about the, I imagine that might feel, right? This attempt at identifying the feeling as you might have as a sender. And what I like about that part of the model that I read was, and practiced, which I say practiced because I'm being reminded that I need to bring some of this back. Nick's not peeing, by the way. He's just pouring some water here. That'd be weird, right? We're doing this. This is urinal chats. What I found really beautiful about the, like, what I hear you're saying, what the hurt is, I imagine that feels, is then I'm starting to code in my own internal experience how I sense your emotion too. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. I'm like, oh, I imagine that feels like you might not feel prioritized. And the person, I'm like, did I get that? And they're like, no. Mm. Okay. How do you feel?
Yeah.
For me, that it reminds me that I need to do that more, with, not just with Kai. I think I've just like forgotten that step of, I mean, I've empathized in our conflicts, but I think I could do better at it. And it makes me think of just general conversations with everyday people, how important the curiosity and the reflection and the mirroring and the validation and the empathy, like, that's what we all want.
Yeah. There's a lot of distortion, like in scientific observation would say that we only hear, like in a calm, relaxed space, like we only hear 13, 14, 15% of what is being said.
That's calm. That's regulated.
Yeah. So in conflict, in upset, this is the problem, is that
what's the percent?
Well, I haven't seen that measurement.
Zero. Yeah. They can't measure it. It's so small. It's, they're like, our machines can't even register empathy here.
But what I'm saying is, like, there's a high level of distortion, you know, in general. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about a measurement like that, it's an average, and it's based on a, you know, general sample of the population. I don't know what the size was. So it's not always going to be the most grounded, present, attuned people when they get this data. But the point is there's a growth opportunity for everyone at large to be more present, to be more attuned, to be there. And it is a beautiful thing.
It's incredible.
To actually listen from a place of curiosity about what's going on and give your partner the space to share that upset, even if it's about something that is uncomfortable or you're worried about the outcome of the conversation that might affect the relationship in some way. It's like, this is what I mean about facing everything, is you have to talk about it at some point in some way through some format, hopefully in a safe way, to resolve the challenge and to get some clarity about it. And maybe there's behavior change, right? The dishes example is kind of classic, like, oh, I'm just not going to do that anymore.
And then not doing it.
And not do it, follow through. But it's funny how much of couples work actually boils down to just don't do that. Don't do that anymore.
Just stop that.
Yeah, stop that. Don't go into your not good enough story. Don't blame your partner, right? Don't hurl insults. Abusive behavior aside, you know, the complaint and criticism thing is just really common. It can be said.
Seems to be just the regular vernacular of couples.
Totally. That's how I get my needs met, right? So it's this thing that gets developed early on, because complaint and criticism is like the adult form of the infant's cry. So when we're younger, you know, we can't express ourselves. So we cry, we get upset, we make noise. And we've evolved that way because we get our caretaker's attention. And then we kind of learn that, oh, okay, I want this candy bar. So I'm going to throw a fit and then I'm going to get what I want. Mm-hmm. And we then end up in relationships as adults, basically with this belief in the background that if I cause you enough pain, you're going to love me the way that I want to be loved.
And you know, that's so familiar, I think, for so many of us. That's why it's easy to feel shame about that awareness, but you must turn towards the truth of the awareness to transform and find connection. Yeah. You know, it really is to know that you're part of your partner's healing and they're part of yours. Now it changes the whole context of connection.
Yeah.
I'm curious. Okay. So what is possible for couples once they begin this learning dialogue, beginning to have this understanding of this framework? What is possible then for the individual too?
Well, there's some humbling parts of this experience, obviously, because when you begin to face everything, as I'm saying, in your relationship, you're undoubtedly going to come up against grief, sadness, mm-hmm. Anger, you know, frustration, resentments, secret fears that you have you didn't realize were running parts of your life. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot there. But, you know, beyond some of the initial process work, you really begin to restore a sense of exploration and nurturance and intimacy and play in the relationship. And this a big deal.
That's a huge deal.
Really having a sense of adult love. It's kind of like in the honeymoon phase, we're just high on our neurochemical supply. I mean, we're just, you know, it's all happening. And
it's pretty good stuff.
Yeah. Yes. So it we're seeing all the similarities, all the things in common. And we get into that power struggle where we're only seeing the differences. And we're thinking, oh, this person's too much this. They're too much that. They're not enough this. And I better get out of here. You know, they're just the source of my pain.
Yeah.
And what a lot of couples do is they end up in a coping phase. And that can be, people cope in all kinds of different ways. They maybe drink a lot, gamble a lot, watch a lot of pornography, stay at work late, hold the newspaper social up media, at the breakfast table, yeah. Social
phones,
media,
yeah.
Phones. Yeah. There's any number of things. Some people do, extreme stuff, like they abuse their partner to cope with stress in the relationship. And, if people are in abusive relationships, I really recommend that they get support to get out in the right way. That's, not necessarily my specialty, but whenever I'm giving relationship advice, I find one of the things that people come up with is like, well, what about like abusive relationships? I'm like, I'm not even speaking in that context. That shouldn't be, that's not a healthy environment to work.
That's aside, get help, get support, get out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what's available to couples? Restoring these things that I'm talking about, closing these energetic leaks that exist in the relationship that we used to cope. And making
that could be connection with other people, right? Texting
it
others,
could
flirting,
be.
Leaving sexual energy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cheating or, other forms of betrayal.
Can be subtle. Yeah.
Yeah. Emotional affairs and so on. There's so many different ways that we do it. Coping we learn. So, for example, this is part of our like nurturance is we can take on one of our caretaker strategies to deal with our current partner. So for example, I'm in a relationship with a woman. And if I look at the way that my father dealt with his stress with my mom, I can see some patterns about how I might relate or have certain thoughts about my own partner. So I've adapted some of the strategies. I've learned, oh, this is how you deal with your partner when she's upset.
I've done that. Yeah. Definitely.
So you learn a little bit about that coping and make a conscious commitment to actually be in a conscious relationship, to practice things we're talking about, to embody safety, to create a relationship vision and bring back a sense of aliveness. Mm. And inevitably, what couples are going to experience is a sense of satisfaction with that. And there's going to be new challenges. But when you get to those new levels, those new experiences, those other core issues that come up, you're going to have the tools, you're going to have practice, you're going to have some foundation that you've built
some
on to
success
say.
Success that you've seen.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful.
What that's really about is resilience.
Yeah.
We're going to work through this, right? We're not just going to throw the relationship out the window because we have these conflicts that we haven't been able to work out.
Yeah, you realize that now you have these tools. We've seen success as a couple. We're turning towards the problem or challenge together, shoulder to shoulder, rather than you're the problem, I'm the problem, whatever the the dynamic may have been before.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. And I would imagine, because there's for sure lots of people listening who aren't in relationship. And my experience of this work has been, you can understand all the things you're talking about and actually use that information to recognize who you're choosing in the dating work, who you're choosing and who you're swiping right and left to, mm-hmm. you know, all of that. You know, and I think of how important that just the understanding of what you're saying, practicing it with work, practicing it with your parents, you know, like that Imago dialogue. Mm. When you first start implementing it in your life, first off, not only does your life get so much fucking better because everyone who's in dialogue with you about anything is like, I really like talking to that person. Like,
yeah,
they might experience being heard for the very first time in their life or like mirrored. They're like, what the fuck is happening here? You're mirroring back.
Yeah.
And you just like, your whole life transforms because what I've found through this work is that I end up in intimate conversation that I never have been in before because all my defensive, protective, whatever strategies always protected me from getting to what was untouched, what was annihilation. Mm. You know, it's kind of interesting. It's like all those mechanisms, which are really just mechanisms to protect ourselves from getting hurt, but often just cultivate living in the hurt.
Yeah.
We're now past. And then we're like, what's swimming in this sea of delicious vulnerability that I'm not sure I want to be in, you know? Yeah. Nick, you're so gifted at talking about this and in your work. I mean, I know numerous people who've done some work with you and just how transformed they've experienced. So do you, just for people listening, where do they find you? Do you work with individuals as well as couples? And how do they get more of your sultry voice?
Yeah.
And your beautiful hair.
Thank you.
And your heart and your soul and all those things too.
You can find me on Instagram at Nick Solacek, and we'll have links in the bio for that, nicksolacek.com. I work with couples and individuals. My practice right now is split about 50-50, and the insights of Imago relationship theory apply. And everyone has a personal relationship story. So everyone that I work with, I help them map that out and to get a sense of what some of the unconscious motivations are for them as an individual and generally for people. And this helps create some significant insight and really makes a difference in terms of their dating process or the relationship that they're in. And I'm very passionate about that. It's just made such a big difference for me and other people that I know in the couples work field. And for the couples that I work with, I just see people transcending really difficult stuff and amazing. Working through it. So it's an honor to facilitate it. And it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on, and maybe more in the future.
Hell yeah. Thanks, yeah. Brother. I appreciate you.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If this episode resonated with you, one of the best ways to support the show is to go subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any more. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to it, or share the episode with your community on Instagram or whatever social place you like to hang out. This helps get it into more people's ears, and I'm so grateful for your support always. Thanks again for tuning in. Much love.